We're going to have an informational overview of the findings on the Oregon Internet Commission. Vince, can you come on up and Pat? Welcome.
Thank you.
In your binders are matches. So there's a bit of us, copy of the Internet Commission. Yes. Please.
Thanks a lot. My name is Vince Piapetta. I'm a professor over at Willamette University College of Law. I'd like to thank you all for inviting us over. I'm the ex-chair of the former Oregon Internet Commission since it's been set in December. I understand what you asked for was general informational overview of what we did in the report, and so we've brought the three of us really to try to do that. We divided the presentation up. I'll give you a brief overview to start. Jim Johnson will then talk to you about the educational aspects. Pat Allen will talk to you about telecommunications, business infrastructure, and an overview on e-government. And then I'll finish up with some legal infrastructure and a few closing thoughts. A little bit of old home week, obviously, Representative Hill, we were privileged to have on the commission. So to the extent that we say something that doesn't sound right or is incomplete, I'll trust that he'll go ahead and fill in the blanks for us. I guess the first question, does everybody have a copy of the actual report? Because it may make it a little bit easier to follow along. Great. Basically, what we found, I think the fundamental message is pretty simple, which is that Internet commerce is a good opportunity to help build a sustainable economy here in Oregon. Oregon is well positioned to take advantage of it. The competition is out there and running, which means that we just need to make some quick decisions and commitments, investments on that, particularly in education, promoting broadband, first-class e-government, non-hospitable business, and legal infrastructure. A couple of highlights that I wanted to point out to you about the commission and its work. First of all, Internet commerce or e-commerce is not just about dot-coms. Most particularly not the e-tailers that people are seeing having trouble in the stock market. It's really a whole approach to doing business remotely using telecommunications network facilities. So it could be a division of companies that everybody recognizes as not being e-commerce, who in fact engaged in e-commerce. And it obviously involves the entire infrastructure around that kind of business, all the service providers and the like. The second is it really is an opportunity. I think it fills a gap that we're seeing in Oregon that obviously moving away from an old manufacturing or natural resources economy, got to move to something else. This is one place where we find something that might be able to help fill in the gaps. It's a clean industry, provides high-paying jobs, gate to being part of the global marketplace, nice fit for tough geographies like ours. So there are a lot of reasons to think of it as an opportunity. Clearly makes it worth a closer look. The the third thing really is that the competitive landscape, however, is pretty tough. And we're not the only ones that have noticed that this opportunity is there, that, in fact, it is having an effect on the way business is done. And particularly, a number of other states are taking fairly aggressive actions. California, you don't need to say a lot about other than their growth and now electrical problems are a little bit of a problem. But states like Virginia, Utah, Colorado, they've got their executive out in front of this. There are a number of other states looking at the issue. They set up boards to review it, making proposals and the like. So the high-level conclusion is that there is something there. We've got a chance to take advantage of it, but we need to decide quickly and move quickly to not do anything is tantamount really to deciding against. The other thing is that if we're going to do it, we're going to have to move aggressively because other people are moving as well, and a few half measures I'm not sure are going to actually get us there. I would leave you with a basic caveat. Of course, we understand that some of these things require big investments, and investing in one thing may mean not investing in something else, and so obviously some very difficult decisions that need to get made. I would leave you with one thought there, that investing can be painful in the short run, but it may provide fairly big feedback in the long run. Anyway, to the report. If you look at page one of the report, numbered Arabic one, not the little Roman one, you'll see that under Commission's recommendations on page one, starting at the bottom of the left-hand column, going to the top of the right-hand column, what we did was basically set out the overview of the proposals, and they really come in three parts. There is a set of specific actions that we recommended as well. There's some comments about the Oregon message about its involvement in e-commerce and some thoughts about implementation. We're going to leave the message and implementation points to the tail end of the conversation, some of the closing remarks I've got, and we'll talk about the specific actions themselves. If you look at pages 1 through 3, you'll see that, in fact, we've got headings priority 1, priority 2, priority 3, priority 4. What we did was we took the mass of issues that are relevant, we felt, to e-commerce or internet commerce, and basically divided them up into a set of substantive areas, which are the areas that lead to the titles that we've got with regard to the priorities. We also, though, realized that we can't always do everything everybody thinks might be a good idea, and so we specifically tried to prioritize where we ought to move first, and that's why we picked the words priorities 1, 2, 3, and 4. They are literally are in order of priority. And within the activities themselves, so within priority 1, for example, we also further tried to prioritize to try to help out to the extent we could in regard to getting focused. Excuse me, just a couple of brief remarks then about those priorities, give you some overview, and then we'll move on to a little bit more detail. First was very clearly education critical path. Without a talent pool, it's going to be a non-starter in Oregon. It's also hard if Oregonians don't have the skills for them to get to participate in the economy. So it goes both ways and gives us both things. Telecom infrastructure, obviously priority 2, again, without the pipes, very little chance that, in fact, you're going to have a robust communications-based kind of economy. E-government was 3, and really, in a lot of ways, a little bit surprising to me, and I think worth focusing on exceptionally, obviously, particularly given the nature of this committee. But it's not just a vehicle for effective and efficient delivery of government services. It goes well beyond that. And if you look under priority 3, the first, second, and finally paragraphs are talking about some other characteristics of investing in e-government that have ramifications for e-commerce and internet commerce themselves. And so I recommend those to you. And then obviously the fourth, business and legal infrastructure, is a way of providing the infrastructure that both facilitates people developing these kinds of business, but also a pull to Oregon to help accelerate the pace. So with that said, it's a sort of general overview of what we did and how we broke things down. I'd like to turn it over to Jim Johnson to talk about the education and then on to EPAM. So, Jim?
Well, I'm Jim Johnson, and I'm here to talk about our priority 1, which was education and workforce. And I think to put it kind of bluntly, without the people, this is all an academic discussion. And, you know, there's lots of things that we can do, but if we don't do the people, then it really doesn't matter. And to kind of cut to the chase, because I know you've all can read the top bullets, is that the current proposal that's in front of us, the budget proposal, which basically says that we should, you know, take our higher education system, take $50 million out of it, and then take $50 million and put it back into specific funds, is absolutely a step in the wrong direction. And what the step says is that, you know, momentum, by and large, which we have driven mediocrity into our university system. It's not to say that the individuals in the system are driving that way, but when you take the macro effects of we hold your tuition and we fix your expenses, and we draw, and then tell you to educate more kids and just continue to do that for less year after year after year after year after year, pay our professors at the bottom of the wage scale competitively nationally, then, you know, you're going to drive that into the system. So California this year, their economy is doing much better than ours. Washington's economy is doing much better than ours. These are states, even Idaho, where they've been making specific investments in this area of technology. And again, it has a huge impact on the entire economy. It isn't about supporting the high-tech sector. It's about supporting the entire economy as it transitions from the old economy to the new. And it isn't that there's these two separate economies. It's we're all just one economy. But businesses are making this transformation, and Oregon businesses are going to have a harder and harder time making this transformation if they don't have the people. Now, the other reality is that the Portland metropolitan area probably can survive this because it's probably gotten to critical mass. It's hard. We've always had an import strategy for our people, but at least now there's enough high-tech activity, there's enough IT jobs, whether it's, you know, in a forest products or a bank, that where if an individual says, oh, I can move here, and if that particular job doesn't work out, I can move to another job, and I don't have to move my family again. And that's an important transition. But if you're trying to support a business in Bend, if you're trying to support a business, you know, in Coos Bay, if you're trying to support a business, you know, in Pendleton, that argument isn't going to hold. Recruiting people into those areas is going to be a big challenge because mobility is critical for these highly professional people. They need to know if the job doesn't work out, they can go to another one. And so I think we're up against a very, very difficult decision. And again, you know, we have historically been taking little steps. Last year, the legislature took a bold step, took a very important step, took a very impactful step by saying, we're going to put $100 million into our university system. That was absolutely the right kind of investment to make. When we hear about Washington is saying, we're thinking about putting $150 million in creating a brand new school of engineering that isn't even in existence today, along with supporting their other great institutions. When you hear about California putting $1 billion into new initiatives to support their economy in the future, you know, driving communications, driving biotechnologies, you know, driving the new technologies that are going to fundamentally underpin their economy 25 years from now, you see that they have that strong base. The other reason why I think this is important is it comes back to money. We are now wrestling with the budget. We wish that we had more revenue. One way to getting that more revenue is simply growing the economy. And I think that, that we have to provide these tools because 25 years ago, centuries ago, our economy was driven by natural resources. People could a high school student could leave high school early, drop out, go down to the local mill, and get a family wage job. That was then, now is now. That isn't possible. If you look at income, you'll find it directly correlates to education. You know, and again, in the accessibility report that was published, I think, a couple of weeks ago, said that Oregon, you know, a higher ed system, there's only one other state west of the Mississippi that has higher state tuition than we do. That's Montana. And the other thing that we had in our state was one of the highest, or I should say one of the lowest, in terms of number of percent of population with a BS degree or higher. In the new economy, the natural resource is going to be that of the mind. Those who are highly educated will prosper. You know, it's not rural against urban. It's not east against west. It's really those who are educated and in part of the new economy and those that aren't. With an average wage of $29,000 across the state and an average wage of $33,000 in the Portland metropolitan area, I don't see that those two numbers say that, you know, the people in the city have it great. But when you look at the average wage of high-tech employees versus non-high-tech, that's where you begin to see a disparity. And you see a $54,000 average high-tech wage across the state, again, versus the $29,000. Or in Washington County, you see $100,000 average wage versus the $33,000. Now you begin to see the disparity. And those who have made the transformation are the ones who will benefit. If we want all of Oregon to participate in the 21st century and to have good family wage jobs, we're going to need to make this fundamental investment. And the unfortunate part about it is that it's a long-term investment. It's you make the investment now, and it's going to take 4, 8, 10 years before you see the real payoff. But if out of this we can generate one Qualcomm-like company, like the University of San Diego did, that has over $1 billion worth of revenue now, that wasn't in existence 10 years ago, if we can generate just one of those, we will pay back all of this investment in spades. So I think the challenge that we have in this very tight economy and this very tight budget cycle that we're all going through is, are we willing to invest in the important over the urgent? And I would strongly advocate that we look at our economic future, we invest in our economic future, and we make sure that all Oregonians can participate. So that's the summary of the workforce and education statement.
Good afternoon. My name is Patrick Allen. I work for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department as its regional officer in Clackamas and Hood River counties, and I represented the department on the Internet Commission over the past few months working on this report. My job today is to hit some highlights for you out of the telecommunications infrastructure, e-government, and business infrastructure portions of our report. I'm not going to cover all of the detailed recommendations here, give you some flavor of some of the most significant ones. The first one is our second priority on page 2, telecommunications infrastructure. At these presentations, Jim usually starts out talking about how the ingredients of a technology economy are people, pipes, and piles of money, I believe it is. Yeah. And really our education recommendations touched on people. Telecommunications infrastructure is the pipes, access to the basic system by which e-commerce and technology is done. I'd like to quote you briefly from the report. The guts of our recommendation here are that the state aggressively promote the existence, maintenance, and constant updating of generally accessible, route-diverse, statewide, reliable broadband telecommunication services, which are essential to e-business. There's a lot of stuff in that sentence, and I'd like to take just a minute to talk about what is in that sentence and also to talk about what's not in that sentence. What's not in that sentence is a call that you go and fund and charge some state organization with building and owning some kind of a system. We're not in any way advocating for a state government telecommunications infrastructure system, separate and apart from systems for its own telecommunications needs. What we are recommending is that the state take a leadership role in recognizing that there is a public policy need for widespread broadband access around the state to telecommunication services, and that there's an appropriate role in advocating for those, in assembling the public-private partnerships necessary to deliver those, and doing all of the kinds of things that are necessary to get private investment to happen, where private investment simply left to its own devices might not always tend to go, which would tend to be the more urban parts of the state. But that kind of route-diverse system around the state is what's vitally necessary to make e-commerce a potential tool, not just in the most urban parts of the state, but statewide. Our third priority area on electronic government, there are three recommendations at the bottom of page 2, and I think I can summarize those simply by saying that these are a set of recommendations calling on the state to deliver as much of what it does for the public through electronic means as quickly as possible, as legally as possible, and as securely as possible. Let me say a little bit about what that means. There are a great many things that can be delivered using with the state as a business entity, if you will, using the tools of e-commerce, motor vehicles registrations, voter registration, at the local government level, library services, and those kinds of things. As legally as possible, though, gets at sort of the conundrum that's faced, which is there are peculiarities about doing business as a state government or as local government that make that difficult. Let me give you an example. Today, given requirements for public disclosure, it would be very difficult for the state to put on a website where you're going to buy a service or pay for a permit the typical kind of a privacy statement that you find on most websites. Much of what would be done on a website today under state law would be publicly disclosable. The pattern of mouse clicks, potentially credit card information, those kinds of things are difficult under current statutes to be able to keep private for customers. There are really two reasons we believe to pursue aggressive delivery of state services through electronic means. One is because it's cheaper and you're able to provide services better and faster in more places, but also because part of being a successful e-commerce-based state is the idea that state institutions and local government help set a standard and help identify themselves as leading-edge entities that are moving forward in that area. Fourth priority is business infrastructure, and I'd like to hit on just one of the recommendations in that area, and that's the creation of e-commerce enterprise zones. Chair Hill, as you know, has a bill in House Bill 2488 to do that. And this is a proposal that we have made that some geographic areas around the state be identified, where we set up a set of incentives to promote the capital development that's necessary to promote e-commerce, to make it not just to promote it, but to make it possible at all, and do it in places and areas where the private sector, the market, wouldn't get there by itself without some kind of capital incentive or other kinds of promotion. And with that, I'd like to turn it back to Vince for legal infrastructure and some wrap-up.
Fair enough. I should have mentioned at the outset, so I'll mention it now. While we have summaries of the recommendations in the front pages, the structure of the report is that the bulk of the report actually is the subcommittee reports of the commission that we're assigned to and did the work on them. And so you'll find more both specific description of the recommendations as well as some background information. So, for example, if you turn to page 17, you'll find the legal infrastructure subcommittee report, which gives you much more expansive information both about the recommendations made there as well as the whys for them. In addition, at the back of the report are some other sections which talk about the commission's process and some findings that we made with regard to what other folks are doing. With regard to legal infrastructure, having saved, of course, the best and most exciting for last, we ended up with two really, I think, high-level thoughts. and they are along the lines of what not to do as well as what to do. And on the what not to do, we looked at the full range, really, of kinds of laws and their effects on the way business develops. And there are a lot of areas where Oregon law is just fine, for example, basic business law. Within the regulatory regimes, to the extent that we deal with frauds and scams, we've got pretty good laws there. Some Hardy Meyers may need a little more money to actually enforce them, given the ability to do more of it on the Internet. But again, not a lot needed. Same thing with regard to long-arm jurisdiction, getting people outside of Oregon that are causing trouble in Oregon. So that really very little needs to be done there, we felt. In areas that are high profile, like privacy, there are some additional difficulties, which include the fact that the Congress is considering over 500 bills with regard to privacy, and to act separately in advance in Oregon is actually fairly disruptive for the kinds of things business need. And I'm not saying that they need to avoid regulation. I'm saying that they need to understand what the rules are, and if what Oregon does in that environment ends up causing conflicts or preemption problems with regard to federal legislation, would actually cause harm rather than help. And so we've really said that in most of those kinds of areas that Oregon ought to adopt a wait-and-see attitude. With regard to what we should do, I think that the key area, actually, of issues and opportunities end up having to do with online contracting. And there are really two separate issues there, and they ought to be treated, I think, separately. One is just the basic question of enforceability, and probably at the simplest level, it has to do with electronic signatures and electronic records. And it has to do with the fact that a lot of this doesn't happen in paper or in otherwise tangible form, and that what we ought to be doing is making sure that, in fact, those kinds of transactions can go forward in a predictable way. And all we're saying is that if it was done online, it's the same as having done it in pen and ink. There are a couple of pen and paper. There are a couple of issues to focus on there, and there's some detail actually in the Legal Infrastructure Subcommittee report. The recent federal legislation, e-sign, has caused some issues with regard to both what we've got here in Oregon and what, in fact, we ought to be doing in Oregon. I think those are very important issues because they will create uncertainty in the business environment. Frankly, there's not a lot of need to have that uncertainty other than failure to act. So that I think there are some issues in there, but they're something that ought to be looked at aggressively in this legislative session. The second issue is a little more problematic from a policy standpoint. It has to do with the terms of online contracting, what goes into those contracts that are electronically formed and done without an actual paper record. And again, the real reason for looking is that for any kind of business to work, predictability is a very important kind or an aspect, a characteristic of the environment, and it just isn't there. Now, the reason for the difficulty, of course, is that the foremost solution that's been proposed to this, and foremost, I don't mean necessarily the best, just the one that is most vocally talked about, is UCITA, the Uniform Computer Information Transactions Act. And it comes with some good and some baggage. And I think that it's going to take some deliberate looking and some deliberate policy decisions about the kinds of trade-offs that get made in a statute which deals with what the content of online contracting is going to be. So there are a number of opponents, number of proponents. Nonetheless, the real point here is that it ought to be looked at, ought to be looked at quickly, again, really for purposes of fostering the certainty and predictability that's necessary in online business. So anyway, those, I think, kind of sum up the different priorities in terms of specific recommendations. I want to leave you with two other thoughts related to the other two aspects of the program we proposed. One has to do with message. And we've called it Oregon Advantage, and there's a report in there as well. We have a special problem in Oregon, partly history, partly just image, as a general proposition. If we build all of these infrastructure components in Oregon, nobody may come anyway. And I think that what we're saying is that we need to change the message from what a fabulous place it is to live, what a fabulous place it is to live and to work, because, in fact, there are very creative people here. There are, in fact, companies already here, and we are creating an infrastructure which is favorable. And to do that, we've got to, I think, get our arms around the message problem. And we've actually suggested the state branding office or something comparable that would coordinate the message and make it one that is getting both has the right content in it and is getting delivered to the right constituencies. So, again, I think it's an important additional piece to the puzzle for us in particular. This last one is related to implementation, and I mentioned it earlier at the beginning. Obviously, there's a need to move quickly in all of this, but that's not the only issue. It's making sure that you have allocated specific responsibility, some way to measure, and some ability to monitor whether, in fact, things are going the way they should. And then probably most critically with regard to implementation is to recognize the proposals we made are a snapshot of the world as it stands now. And that one of the things I can guarantee you, if nothing else, is it will continue to change. And so that one of the things that Oregon ought to be doing is making sure that they recognize this as an ongoing event, not a one-time deal, and that there ought to be some process put in place to continue to monitor the situation as it evolves, watching for curves in the road, making sure that, in fact, we're getting an appropriate return on investment. So I would leave you again with the conclusion that I started with. It's a very big opportunity here. Oregon is well positioned to take advantage of it, but it's going to take some quick and thoughtful but urgent action on our behalf to make sure that we take advantage and get the word. I'd leave it back to Jim and Pat if you have anything to add, and otherwise we're set.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't have any questions. Without getting into the specific in terms of the Internet Commission, because I've had some further discussions, this whole concept in this space in terms of science and technology, because electronic commerce is one component of a much larger issue in terms of what is your opinion in terms of how we as a state can focus our attention in this in these areas to, so that we don't lose touch and it's fast changing, so we've got a good feedback loop so we understand what we should be doing and always sort of striving for innovative way. Have you any thoughts in terms of that, having gone through this process in terms of...
You're talking about, for example, what kinds of ongoing processes or institutions or structures we could have in place. I think that the way the commission itself was set up was actually a fairly good model. I mean, we ended up with a pretty good diversity of people on there from government, private sector, education. And I think a lot of being able to keep your finger on the pulse is finding the pulse. And so that I think that you need to make sure, in fact, you've got people that are independently in touch with what's going on. And again, just speaking for myself, I mean, I thought it was an amazingly connected group of people, and I think that's absolutely vital because it's different to conjecture than to actually be involved. So of all the thoughts that I could give you, I think I'd leave you with that one, which is making sure that it isn't a group that's on the sidelines trying to watch and find out what's happening, but a group that's actually involved, and whether it's standing or rotating or whatever, I don't really have any opinions on, but I think actually having the connection that into the environment is going to be absolutely vital.
I just wanted to go through maybe some of your solution pieces. I understand the money part of it. I understand the investment in higher ed, but I wanted to go through some of the issues and maybe, you know, if you had bills that, I don't know what bills the commission has introduced. We have a list of...
There are a number of bills, and trying to get all the sum total. Some are in the Senate, some are on our side.
But are there bills for all these solutions that you've proposed that you're aware of? Like, I'm looking at the Education Workforce Subcommittee report.
Okay.
I'm looking at your recommendation, recommended solution one on page 7. And I'm saying, talked about this during the interim.
Right.
Joint Information Management Technology Committee. I mean, I've talked to you gentlemen several times, I think,
right.
And so I'm wondering where we're at. Are you guys happy with going on?
Sure.
I don't want to drag you back here 8 times during the session, nor do you probably have time to come back.
Again, this is Jim Johnson, and let me address those specifically. I think there's a couple issues here that we've got to explicitly address. Again, if you look at number one, there's really 3 recommendations there, even though it says 1AB, because in the paragraph of 1, it says that we need to, fully fund the engineering cells. So again, what the current proposal of the overall university system is that we're going in the opposite direction. So instead of funding the cells at 88%, we're going down to 81%. Which is what that $50 million that we pull out of the university system does, that then in turn gets reallocated to specific programs. So, in order for an engineer to be an engineer or for an IT guy to be an IT guy, they have to go through their undergraduate process, and they have to go through their freshman and their sophomore years taking math and science and English and all those other things. So even though I'm an advocate of supporting engineering cells, by disinvesting in the other cells, you're also making it harder to support the overall mission that we're trying to accomplish. So then, so if we, you know, if we can't fund all the cells, at least try to fund some of the engineering cells, and now maybe I should just be saying, let's try to keep the cells whole where they were and not disinvest. So once we get through that, then we say, okay, the two specific goals that we need to do is we need to double the number of engineers that the state is producing so that more companies in the state would be able to have a larger pool to hire from, so that not only companies in the Portland metropolitan area, but companies out through the entire state have access to an educated, a technically educated workforce. The ETIC, the Engineering Technology Industry Council, which was again formed by the legislature two biennium ago, has put forth a proposal to invest $30 million to get you to that 2X goal. I mean, actually technically 1.85, but get us closer to that 2X goal. And that was submitted to the Board of Higher Education, and the Board of Higher Education endorsed that plan and passed that on to the governor. The second B was to create a top 25 school of engineering. There were competing proposals that went to the State Board of Higher Education. What emerged out of the State Board of Higher Education was a plan that they called their top tier slash peer improvement plan. It recommended investing $10.6 million. It's actually an eight-year proposal, but the first year was to make a $10.8 million investment. The majority of that money would go to one school to create a top 25 school of engineering. They would also put some other money into three other schools, and then in that case, that money would have to be matched by private industry. Actually, the $30 million proposal ETIC for the 2X would be matched by private. What the industry guaranteed was for basically every dollar put in by the state, they'd put in 50 cents. If we actually look at the results of the first biennium investment of the $5 million, we matched that dollar for dollar, industry did. If we look at the current biennium where there's a $10 million investment, we're going to be closer to $20 million. So I feel very confident that the for every dollar, the 50 cent match, I sure will exceed that, but that's the commitment. And then in the...
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
For a second, Jim. I understand the money ones, and we'll deal with those, I guess, as we move along, especially in the co-chairs, but I'm trying to deal with some of the other ones, though the policy things that we as a legislature can do that are not necessarily the dollar-related ones. I think a lot of those other things are going to happen in education and the other budget subcommittees that are going to go on, and I think we're going to start the policy initiatives at least from this particular committee. Then we're going to look at the IT stuff as a budget committee as well, in terms of more of the e-government kind of things. But I'm wondering, like on the, you know, like on page 7, you have a recommended solution on like change the state constitution laws that restrict state universities from effectively transferring technology. Right. Have you guys worked something out? Are you happy with that? Is there?
I can answer that question.
Okay.
Senator Hartung has that legislation.
Okay.
Which is being introduced in the Senate, and I can get you a copy of that legislation. There's three
okay.
pieces. So there's the constitutional amendment. There's a implementation once the constitutional amendment goes, and then there is a interim recommended strategy in terms of on the issue of holding equities.
Okay.
So.
But are there bills related to everything from the commission on the policy side?
It's all in process.
I obviously agree with that. The one thing I would add is there are a few places like the state branding office or like the promotion of the telecommunications infrastructure which really call for assignment to a particular organization of some kind. And I think mm-hmm. that those are the kinds of things, I think you're asking a good question. They're likely to fall through some of the cracks. And so, I think there's a lot. there are a lot of bills out there. The question at the end of the day is, are there some things in the interstices there that ought to get picked up? So I think you're asking a fair question. I certainly would agree with Representative Hillsby. There are a lot of the things.
I'm making sure to go through and make sure that where it says the legislature should.
As long as you're capturing all the bills, Representative Hill, I am happy.
There'll be a lot of bills introduced in terms of, and then, you know, where they go and how we work with the system is another issue, but we're going to capture all of the recommendations and make sure they're all introduced and going forward in the system.
And I would, okay.
I'm sorry.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like some of the recommendations. In fact, I guess I like them all pretty much, especially the ones about doing what we can to prepare a better educated workforce to meet the immediate needs. But one of the concerns that I have is, while focusing all of this money on the higher ed component, our K-12 system isn't preparing children well enough to enter those schools. And I'm hoping to do a better job of keeping Oregonians and children of Oregonians engaged in the process. You may or may not know that some of the skill centers around the state are facing a $26 million cut. And it's those very skill centers that turn out the kinds of kids that are likely to enter those engineering programs. I'm wondering if you have specifically thought of that or have some solutions in mind that we might avail ourselves of to fill that gap, to bridge that gap.
Actually, again, this is Jim Johnson. I think this comes down to a really important policy decision that I think is something that we haven't been willing to do yet. And that is that I think both the State Board of Higher Education as well as our State Board of Education needs to declare that some disciplines or some things are, I'll say more important, I'll be so bold for a moment, that that we need to be encouraging our young people to go into math and science related activities, that if we choose to invest $4.8 billion or $5.2 billion or $5.6 billion, that's a lot of money. And are we really focusing that money on where it can deliver the best societal benefit as well as the best economic benefit? And, you know, I have to accept, just as any business person or any household has to accept, that there are limits to the financial, you know, resources that one has, and that sometimes you have to make choices. And what we haven't yet been able to do, and what I would like to explore in terms of, I don't know how to do it, but in terms of a policy decision that says, let's say that these things are to be more important. Let's say to teachers, we need you to emphasize math and science more. We need you to, you know, do things. And again, there's industry absolutely is willing to participate in this. I mean, Intel has our information center that we bus kids to all the time to try to encourage them or expose them to, you know, new and different things that would hopefully excite their interest so that they would want to pursue these areas. But even if we don't get more money, which you know I very much want in this area, then the question becomes, do we just spread the money that we have and drive mediocrity further into the system, or can we focus that energy so that we can still expect excellence in certain areas? And so I think the other policy, and back to page 7 where we talked about action item 1 was for the constitutional change, I also believe we need to be directing our Board of Higher Education and our Board of Education to place more emphasis, and as a policy decision, say we need to make this happen, even in limited resources, because ultimately this is what will drive the economic engine of the state, that will drive the revenue of the state, that will allow us to have more money to invest. And so is there a way to do that? Is there a way for our Board of Higher Education, our Board of Education, to direct the different districts or the different universities to put more emphasis on this, to fund this before that? And again, in industry, that happens all the time. But in government, it's a more challenging process in order to do that. And, you know, is that something that can be legislated? I don't know.
I refer to it as the peanut butter method of funding. Everybody gets some does just thicker than, sometimes it's just thicker than others.
Yes. Some get the peanuts, some don't.
Any additional questions? Did I answer your question?
If I have a thought, I'm intrigued by your assertion that industry, and I have seen wonderful instances where industry has advanced a partnership, private-public partnership, in various parts of the education system. And I am aware that you've had a special training, a specialized training Intel has done for teachers to help them improve their skills as they bring computers and so forth into the classroom. But I'm wondering if there's a partnership in the works for these skill centers. Seems to me that that's where we ought to focus our public-private partnership.
And you know,
those are such important programs, and there's no room for them in the community college budget or in some of the other budgets. So that's very troubling to me. I agree with you that this is what we need to do. I just don't know how to do it.
Well, I can't speak to the specific, but I ask myself, if it's so important and there's money there, why are we choosing to spend it on something else? And therefore, by our actions, we're stating that the other things are more important than this because we're not funding this, whatever this is in this case. And so, we seem to keep saying the way momentum drives everything. The way we were doing it is the way we will continue doing it unless some change goes in. And it appears that the only way we can get something new is to keep doing the old and then fund the new. In industry, when tough times hit, we don't cut back just to meet the tough times. We'll cut back further, 5-10% more, so that we've got 5 or 10% to invest in the future. Because we know if we're not investing in the future, there won't be any. And these difficult decisions we're making now, next year will be more difficult, and the year after that more difficult, because we aren't generating the new revenues that we need to make. So again, how do we, if something is critical, and if these centers are critical to the future, then why aren't we funding them? What is taking a higher priority? And ask yourself, is what we are currently funding more important than this? I think a policy decision may be one way of trying to drive that prioritization, to try to change that just because we did it in the past doesn't mean that by definition that gets the highest priority, and something new that's critical for the future is the new thing that has to get funded. I would ask, let's look at the least productive thing we're doing, the least effective thing we're doing, and even though it is important, maybe it's not as important as what needs to be done. And again, who drives that in our government? Who is the accountable person, our individual or department, that makes that decision? And I think that's what we've got to drive towards. We have to have accountability in the system. In business, it's clear. The CEO is accountable. And when my CEO says jump, I ask how high and what direction.
Yeah, policy. One of the difficulties that I have observed in the education process of our young people is that instead of being focused and turning out a single product as your industry might, you know, or a cluster of products, we have to turn out whole people. And when you sit there and say, well, what are you going to cut? I'm thinking, okay, what would I cut? What I cut? Music, art, athletics. Yeah. It's hard to cut any one of those things and turn out a whole person. So in times of dwindling resources, I guess what I'm looking for is a magic wand in your hand to wave over the educational system so that we can continue to turn out whole people but have them technologically prepared to meet your needs and to take Oregon into the future.
I think that is a challenge, yes.
Tough call.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
We will continue this conversation here. Representative Patridge sort of asked me the question, what are we going to do to sort of monitor this? And I think that's one of the questions that I have. You know, my initial reaction is let's just reestablish the commission and give it sort of a continuing mission to sort of oversee the implementation of these ideas and concepts. But I don't know if that's too narrow. And so looking for concepts and ideas in terms of maybe more of a sort of a science and technology bent, and where we could take from other agencies where they have mission and squish it together and give it purpose. So I don't know what that structure is or how you flush that totally out, but any concepts or ideas as we go forward here would be very useful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2040. And do get the sheet. Welcome.
First, let you explain the bill is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2040 requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules for the governance of digital signatures by state agencies. These rules must be able to protect the security of the state agency's electronic business transactions and to ensure that those transactions can be audited. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chairman Hill and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Lundeen. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services Information Resource Management Division. I'm the Electronic Commerce Manager for the state. We're recommending passage of the language change to House Bill 2040. The original language in the bill could have led someone to believe that the Department of Administrative Services was responsible for the misuse of digital signatures by a private party. And by putting this language in that saying we'll be responsible for adopting the rules for state agencies, this clarifies the original intent. And it's really a very simple, straightforward request and language change. There is some discussion that I wanted to bring up that the federal e-sign and the Oregon's Universal Electronic Transaction Act and our own digital signature legislation, how those will come out in terms of whether we need to adopt additional legislation or even changes to the statute for digital signatures is going to be taken up under the discussion of the bill for UEDA. And I would say that you could adopt this request to change now regardless of what happens later, just because we don't know what will happen. But I'll leave that for your discussion. Do you have any questions?
No. So I think you said it well. It's just a very minor change, just to clarify. It doesn't, because when we drafted this originally in 97, in terms of is we wanted DAS to be responsible for the infrastructure and how agencies did it.
Yes.
And so we didn't want every agency coming up with their own digital signature system.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions?
Nope. Works for me.
Jim Craven. I'm looking for who else to come and testify. You want to come up and testify? Come up.
Kind of lonely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Jim.
For the record, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. I'm sorry I was pulled out in the hall by another member of your committee, but
you went through all this, Pat?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to echo the analysis under the discussion section here is that we've got this interesting little dance between the federal e-sign law that has some preemptive pieces, not fully on the states, allow states to do UEDA, but only under certain circumstances. I know we'll get into that next week on the 31st when you hear the bill, but just to let you know, there is a group of the Oregon State Bar and a bunch of certified smart attorneys from Portland trying to wrestle all through this, as I explained to your staff last week. I can't guarantee they'll have it all solved by next Wednesday, but people are. Get the current digital signatures law in Oregon, the e-sign act, UEDA bill, and trying to, as well as DOJ counsel, I think people are all working together, and I don't think it's a major contention issue as much as just technically getting it right so we don't have to repeal it later in the session or do it again next time. So I just want to echo the comments from Pat that there's people working on UEDA, and hopefully we'll get this straightened out. The feds didn't deal us a really great deck of cards in sort of passing the federal law that sort of preempted state actions in some areas.
The deadline of March.
And there's this deadline of records retention and whatever, but I think we'll have a good. I think we'll know enough by next Wednesday to have a good hearing next Wednesday, and then hopefully move forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else that I would like to testify on House Bill 2040? With that, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Chairman.
Representative Long.
Have we got an amendment to this thing yet?
No.
Are we doing one?
Nope.
Oh.
Not that I know of.
The way it goes. Okay.
It's very straightforward.
Thank you.
I think it could also be a candidate for our consent agenda.
Ah. Mr. Chairman, I move passage of House Bill 2040 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Lowe moves House Bill 2040 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Lowe, did I hear you make a motion to place this on the consent agenda?
Yes, sir, you did. Didn't everybody in here hear me?
Discussion? Without objection.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we need a contingency carrier in the event that it isn't appropriate for the consent agenda or there are questions that arise, and I sure as heck don't want it to be me.
I will be more than happy to carry the bill in the case of failing the consent agenda. With that, let's open a work session. In your packets, three bills, LC 2461 and 2462, they were affectionately placeholder bills for issues that will probably come before this committee. And then Senator Deckard asked, tell us, do you have the name of the person who this will be a committee bill at the request of?
There was a person
of the Grange that is a contact person. It was like the Tiger Grange.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a Grange bill though.
Is that the
Grange? Okay. So it'll be a committee bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll find out who the request up. I think there's a specific person. So I motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that we adopt LC 2461, 2462, and 2524 as committee bills for this committee.
Representative Patrick has moved LC 2461, 2462, and LC 2524 as committee bills. Committee bills. Discussion?
We're not moving them all to the floor, are you?
No, just in the committee. Committee bills.
I think it might be nice to have 2524 stay at the.
There will be a representative persons, and you know, the introduction of the bill does not necessarily commit anyone to supporting it.
Understood. I'd be under arrest immediately if that passed. So. Okay.
Any further discussion? Is there any objection? Without objection, so. What else do we have? That completes our agenda today. I will let you know that the House committee is going to be moving to a Tuesday-Thursday schedule, the same time frame. So, and then working it out that the Ways and Means will go Monday, Wednesday, and I'm working on the Friday issue.
Thank
so,
you.
So we're gonna our next meeting will be next Tuesday.
I think we will move. It'll depend on we schedule the 31st people to come, and if we can move it to a Tuesday, we will. If not, we'll continue with that one. But in the future, it'll be Tuesday, Thursday schedule.
Much better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I will try to continue to make our stay and our work here as pleasant as possible.
And that'll be 3:30 or 3.
Same time.
3-ish.
So, without objection, we are adjourned.